Welcome to Live Daf, your online Daf Yomi Shir.
Shalom Aleichem and welcome back to today's Daf Yomi. Zvachim Kofei, we begin 6 lines off the top of the Amid. Another question in the name of Rabbi Elazar regarding the Purim Hanisrafim and the Seirim Hanisrafim, right? So these Karbonis whose dam is applied internally on the Mizbeach, in the Heichal, etc. And then the actual behema, the actual par, the cow, or the so'ir, the goat, is to be taken outside, transported outside Yerushalayim to the Beis Hadash and that special burning area. And the halacha is, as we learned yesterday, the fellow who actually handles this exportation and or the individuals involved in getting it all burnt up, they are metame begodim. There's a special tumah applicable to them. They become tame and it extends to their clothing. Now, as we learned yesterday, the tumah happens when they leave. Okay, according to Tanakama, the one who's actually transporting it at that boundary point, when he leaves the area, when he leaves the premises of the Azorah, as soon as he takes the par v'soir outside, the tumah gets activated. Now comes an interesting question. Boy, Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar has a question. Purim u'seirim hanisrafim. Okay, these karbanis, shiyatsu, that had left the premises, okay, they were taken out. V'chazru, then returned back inside. Mao, what's the status of those people carrying the karban? Shall we say, well, too late, too bad. Once you left with the karban, even though you brought it back, your begadim become tummy. It doesn't get canceled. Or shall we say, once the behemoth is now back inside, it sort of cancels the whole process. It's as though you never left. Because after all, it's back inside, right? And came back in. Ma, what's the status of the of these individuals and their begadim? Ma, mi yamrina, shall we say, kivin the nafki luhu. Look, once they went out with the parim, itamu luhu, they become tummy. Or shall we say, kivin the hader, once they're back inside, hader. Once they came back inside, they're back. Okay, so turn back the clock. Let me try to resolve this based on the Mishnah. Okay, so we learn in the Mishnah, they were carrying the karbanis using poles, and we have people in the front, the lead, people. We have people in the back. Harushanim yatsu. As soon as the lead individuals exit the wall of the Azar, but the ones in the back have not yet left, the lead fellows that left the Azar become tummy, but not the ones behind. The ones behind do not have tumas begadim ad shiyatu, until they leave as well. The question is, why are the ones behind spared of tumas begadim? Look, the focal point is the par itself. Right? When the par leaves the area, the carriers become tummy. Now, in this case, did the par leave? Of course. Right? The lead people in the front had carried out the par. It's just that the ones in the back are still lingering and still, inside the wall. So what? Their begadim should become tummy as well. Although they're left behind for the time being, but the event already occurred. The carriage occurred. So it's similar to having left and come back. Similar idea. Because the leaving took place, the exiting took place. Just they happen to be stuck behind. You're going to tell me, if you're going to suggest that regarding your question posed a minute ago, that if you take it out and come back in, once and they leave, itamu. Right. So once the behemoth, the carbon is taken out, even if it's returned back, the carriers become tummy, they stay tummy, they don't lose their tumah. Likewise, the same should happen here regarding the fellows in the rear. Those individuals are still inside, right? Because they're clutching the backside of the poles. Nami litami, they should become tummy as well. Because the event occurred. It's already outside. They happen to be inside. It's like he went out and came back in to a certain extent. Amaravina. No. How could he even suggest? Your premise is an error. These individuals that are still behind, that never left, why would you say they're tummy? Vitisbro. How can you suggest as such? Of course you have to first leave. There's no question you have to first leave to trigger that tumah. How about, you know, we require. The pasuk says, come back in, right? Va'achar yavel ha'machab. The pasuk says, when they leave, with the par, right, they become tummy, then you can come back inside. Which means that you're outside. V'leka, but if you never left, then v'leka, this is not really applicable to you. Meaning, what Ravina is telling us, is that the tumah of tumas begotten is contingent upon leaving. Of course, before you leave, there's nothing to talk about. So you can't really make any correlation to this case. We spoke about a fellow who took it out and came back in. But you're attempting to provide clarity from a case where he never left. Says the Gemara, you're right. Ella Rabbi Lazar Hechi Boila. Let's skip this whole sort of misunderstanding, misconception in Rabbi Lazar's question. Of course, in the event that we described, that they transported the par outside, and then, you know, came back in. Of course, they don't become toher. Once the tumah is applied, it's a done deal. Likewise, there's no question that if a fellow never left to begin with, even if he's participating in the carrying process, but he's still inside, of course he's not. So what then was the question? El Rabbi Lazar, Hechi Boila. What was his question to begin with? It's like this. We're talking that the pyre was taken out and then return back inside. But you have an individual who's standing on the outside holding onto the pyre with a pole. So picture like this. The pyre was taken out, and then back inside. Comes along an individual to help it being taken out again, to be taken out again. So he's standing on the exterior, on the outside, sort of reaching over with a pole, holding the pyre which is still back inside. So he's really outside in fulfillment of the pasuk va'achar yavel ha'machna, which in the case that he's out, he's already outside. But in contrast to the standard halacha, where we learn that the tumah gets activated when the power is taken, the power is back inside. But the thing is, the power is already outside. It's already exported material, even though it's currently back inside, but it's exported material. Perhaps it can activate tumah on the fellow standing on the exterior, holding on to it. Kigoyin de nekitila, they're holding on to the par bebekulsi with these poles. In this case, you can consider both options. Shall we say they're tummy? Because they're handling. From the outside, they're handling a par which is already exported material. Or you can say no. Once the par was returned to the interior, the tumah is no longer going to be generated until it's taken out. Interesting shaka. Tana Rabbanan. Okay, we speak about how this carrying process affects the carriers and their begadim. Here comes a braisa, which discusses that aspect and also the fact that these animals will actually transmit tumah to anything that touches them, like food and drink, right? There's a tumah that's self-generated by these animals to food and drink that it touches. So although we don't treat it like a heavy generator of tumah, if a person merely touches these animals, it doesn't become tummy. It's not like an avha tumah that, you know, is metami a person or a utensil. Regarding a person, he only contracts tumah through a very specific process, through carrying it, handling it, burning it, right? Otherwise, just touching the animal doesn't make you tummy. But if the animal touches food, then the food becomes tummy, as we're going to see. Tana Rabbanan. Parim. So these these cows, these parim and these seirim, right, that are meant to be burnt. Upara, para here is the para aduma, which likewise is going to be burnt outside Yerushalayim. Vesora mishtaleach, that's the goat that's sent out to the desert on Yom Kippur. So all those involved in this process, hamishtaleach, the one that carries out the walks out the soir to the midbar, vasorfan, those that are involved in burning these animals, vamitzian, and transporting these animals outside, mitame begodim, right? So the fellow who travels out with the soyer, who burns, who carries, mitame begadim, his begadim become tame. So he becomes tame and extends to his begadim. Vehei natzman, but ironically speaking, these animals themselves ain mitame begadim. So let's say a garment comes into contact with any of these beings, they don't become tame. Okay, so it's only a very specific type of tumah. The individual who handles them, he becomes tamei and is begadim as well. Okay? So they don't have the ability to mutabi begadim. Avo metam and oichle l'mashkin. However, we have an exception. Food and drink do become infected by touching these things. They become tamei. Divir amir. That's Ramei's shit. So whether it's the dead, you know, parim and then the seirim, or even alive, soira mishtalech, which is an unusual thing that a live animal should transmit tumah, Rameer says, they all transmit tumah in a lighter form to food and drink, as we're going to see soon. V'chachamim, I mean, they disagree somewhat. The dead animals, yes, but a live animal? That's totally inconsistent with the, you know, accepted norms, with the rules of tumah. We never find that a live animal transmits tumah. This is no different. Okay, so to say that the para nisraf, nisra nisraf, and paraduma are self-generators of tumah with respect to food and drink, yes, but not a live animal. That's it's a phenomenon unfound anywhere. So that certainly will not happen here. V'chachamim ayin para, that's the paraduma. Uparim, that's the para nisraf. Metamun echlan mashkin. We agree. Any food and drink that comes into contact with these animals becomes tam. But soira mishtaleach, a live goat, transported out to the desert on Yom Kippur, ain't no mitami. That's not going to transmit tumah to food and drink. You know why? He's a living animal. We never find out a living animal can transmit tumah to food and drink. Now, let's try to understand Rameir. Bishlemi the Rameir could turn to Rabbi Shmuel. Rameir is in line with the Braisa, the Tanu, the Rabbi Shmuel. The Pasuk speaks about a general halacha that food can become tamei, provided that it gets rinsed first, as it gets washed, it's moisturized. It's called Hechsher L'Kabbal Tumah, right? That enables, that sort of opens the door for contracting tumah. But interestingly, the Pasuk, rather than making reference to plain food, speaks about seeds, interesting, right? I'll call zera zeirua. So what's the significance of seeds, right? Seeds which get wet, you know, the pasuk says they can become tamei, right? Provided A, they got wet, and B, they touch something which you know, transmits tumah to them. They have to get the tumah from elsewhere. They can't self-generate tumah, right? So we learn. Compare everything to seeds. Ma'az roim. What's unique about seeds? Shein soifin li tamei tumah chamura. A seed can never acquire a severe level of tumah. In this case, it means like avah tumah. Like a nevela, a carcass, a dead lizard, a mace, avia voisatuma. Seeds can never get to that point. At most, it can get a lower level of tumah. So if a nevela touches a seed, the seed gets a tumah, but it's a limited, it's a rishon tumah. Right? Sort of a sub level. And then it can transmit tumah to another food, etc. So only seeds which don't have the ability to rise to the highest level of severe tumah, that's why you have all these conditions. before it becomes tummy. First of all, it has to get moisture right, shrichim hechsher, and it has to come into contact with another source of tumah. It's not a self-generator, it's not a source of tumah on its own. Again, that's because it's seeds, and has limited capacity for tumah. And likewise, other materials that share similar characteristics as seeds, afkol shein soifin l'tama tumah chavur, which can't acquire a high level of tumah, likewise has to follow the same system. Shrichim hechsher, you have to get it moisturized and come into contact with a source of tumah, which it will acquire. As opposed to an item, if you find a material that can get to a very high level of tumah, for instance, yotzes as opposed to nivlas oiftar, a kosher bird that died, an avail of oiftar, shesayfil tamat tumah chamura. The fact is, it acquires a very high level of tumah. In fact, it's a self-generator of tumah. It's its own source of tumah. The halacha is, if one touches a nivlas eiftar, it doesn't really make him tummy, but if he eats it, there's a unique halacha here. If a person eats it while he's swallowing the available eiftar, he and his begadim become tummy. Evidently, the nivlas eiftar has greater capacity. It can generate a very high level of tumah. And therefore, it doesn't have to follow those rules. It doesn't need to get washed. It doesn't need to touch other tumors to become tummy. It's a self-generator of tumor. Ve'in tzricha hechsher. Doesn't have to be enabled. Doesn't have to get wet. And even if it never touched a source of tumor, it's its own generator of tumor. Likewise, says Rameir, in our discussion regarding the parim, the paraduma, and everything, since, as we learned, they have the ability to generate tumor, to whom? To the individuals involved in processing them, carrying them, burning them, which are tumah chamura, time of the person and his begadim. So they're self-generators. They don't need the hechsher system. They don't have to follow the conventional system, which typically enables material to become tummy, hechsher and touching other sources of tumah. And likewise, by extension, says your mayor, even a live animal, you don't have to fit the rules. You don't have to follow the conventional track. Yeah, typically an animal, while it's alive, is not metame, but here it's different. These have greater capacity. These are seifu letame tumah chamura. So A, they don't have to get washed. B, they're self-sources of tumah. They don't have to get their tumah from elsewhere. And C, even a soir la'zazel, while it's alive, if he touches food, becomes tummy. That's Rameir's sheet. Okay, so according to Rameir, it's all good and well. Ela l'Rabbanan. But the Rabbanan will say that the para, aduma, etc. are metame food and drink. Okay. But not the live animal. Soira mishtalech, no, because live animals are never metame. Well, I don't understand. We're not talking about conventional materials. Yeah, surely, typically, live is not metame, but here it's different. They're metame to mechamur, they have a greater capacity, which even the Rabbanan agree applies in this case. The fact is that they agree that the paraduma will be metame food upon contact. So apparently it is a self-generator of tuma. El Rabbanan yislu, the Tanya Bishmol, if they concur with the Braisa, that's something which can eventually metame to mechamurah, already currently has the power to be metame a light or tumah with respect to touching food and be metame it. So then apply it to all cases. Afilu Sarah Mishtalech, even the live animal, Sarah Mishtalech, should have a tumah kala now. Be lessly, if they don't concur with Rabbi Shmuel's, fundamental, Afilu Parah or Parah Minolon. So then how did I know that the Paraduma or the Parah Minstrafim will transmit tumah to food and drink? Perhaps it only applies to the person and his clothing while he's handling it. But who says there's a plain, simple transmission of tumah upon contact to food? So, it's either all or nothing. How could you adopt it partially and ignore the other part? Says the Gemara. I'll explain to you why where the Chachamim are coming from. They hold that although the these parim and these things are different than your, you know, conventional food and drink. These are things that can generate tumah. But Rav Shmuel never meant to say, they totally bust the guidelines. Sure, they're exceptional. Sure, they're different. You know how they're different? In one thing. Typically, for something, let's say food, for it to be problematic, for it to generate tumah, to transmit tumah to something that it touches, food is not naturally tummy. It has to get, has to import its tumah from elsewhere. It has to touch something, get the tumah, and transmit it further. That is not required by these parim. They are self-generators, self-made tumahs. Okay. So in that sense, they're different. So if they touch food and drink, they become tummy. That's not to say that we bust the rules. Right? It's a live animal, which is never mitame, no different here. Don't take it that far. Rameir took it even further. He says, well, we bust the rules. There are items that merely import and then transmit. There are self-generators. Self-generators? Different system. They don't have to conform to the standard rules, even a live animal, even, right? No, Rabban, don't take it that far. One thing we agree, they don't have to derive that tumah from elsewhere. They self-generate it. But again, you have to sort of fit the guidelines. You have to follow the norms. A live animal is not metame, period. Okay, that's the point. Kiosur of Dimi, or Dimi came here, it's a they explained, Amar explained, Amar Rabban, it's a they explained as follows. The Chacham learned that Tanur Bishmo wasn't taking it that far. Tzrichen Hechshe Tumah Mokim Acher. What he meant to say is that typically, food has to receive tumah in order to transmit it. It's not a self-generator, as opposed to these, are self-generators. But again, it has to fit the guidelines, live animals, not matam. Okay? So let's just recap. Those who are, you know, handling the parim, etc., they become tummy, the clothing become tummy. But what about just plain simple tumah upon contact? You know, a piece of food touched the par, does it become tummy? The answer is yes. Because if they're self-generating tumah, it's a very severe tumah, certainly they also exhibit a plain standard tumah, which will affect any food that touches them. According to Rameh, we take it a step further. Even the live Sarah Mishtalech has that ability to. By Rabbi Lezer, it comes an interesting question. Again, the name of Rabbi Lezer. Parim Usiron Astrafim. Mau Shitamu Oichlon Mashkim Befnim. Kibachotz. So, let's say they haven't yet been transported. They have not yet been exported. So the Tumah Chamura, again, which means the more severe Tumah that impacts the people that are involved, hasn't yet been activated. It only happens when it's taken out. So it's still inside. So the par is inside. Now food touches it. What's the status of that food? So the par has potential to generate a very severe tumor. But hold it. In a minute, when it's taken out, it's not yet there. On the other hand, you can say, well, it doesn't matter. If this is a generator of tumor, so even now, already in this early stage, while it's still inside, before take, it's already metame, food and drink. Shall we say mechusar yetzia? The fact that it was not yet exported, kimechusar mahasadam, it's still missing a component in the development of its tumah. It's not yet activated. Or lo, maybe not. Meaning to say that it's already a source of tumah, and it affects the food that it touches. Basar, the bayah, the pashta, after it was posed, he resolved, he says, it's too early in the game. Mechusar yetziah, kemechusar masadami. You know, if it wasn't taken out yet, it's still lacking, it's still missing. The tumah has not yet been fully developed. There's no issue at this point. Boim name, Rab Abba bar Shmuel, Rab Chia bar Abba. I have a new question. So we said, according to Rav Meir, we bust the rules. Something which has the ability to metame tumah chamura is metame even in ways that are not conventional, even a live animal. And the Gemara is assuming that, let's say, a nevela va'if tohar, which again is another example of something which is metame tumah chamura because it makes you very tummy when you eat it, right? While you're swallowing it. And likewise, even before you eat it, the item itself can generate tumah to food that it touches. But typically, when food transmits tumah needs to have a shear of a kibetz. That's the halacha. An egg, you know, a volume of an egg. On the other hand, the tumah chamura that a nivlized aiftar generates upon swallowing it relates to even a smaller amount, a kazayis, which is the shear of achila, right? It's not an interesting question. So we say nivlized aiftar is metame while you swallow it. If you swallow kazayis, metame tumah chamura. But even before you swallow it, it's a source of tumah and can affect food and drink that it touches. How much nevela do you need to generate tumah? How much? Do you say, well, it has to be a kibetza, which is the typical volume required for food to transmit tumah to other food? Or do we say, no, this is different? Because the tumah chamura, which will eventually be generated by this nevela iftar, is by way of kazayis upon eating. So perhaps even before you eat it, the nevela is matami tumah kala, when it touches food and drink. Also, a shir kazayis is all that's needed. So again, we're busting the rules. According to our mayor, perhaps we could bust the rules. We don't have to conform to standard procedure. Just as our mayor says, a live animal can be matami tumah kala, because eventually it's matami tumah chamura. So perhaps a kazayis of the nevela could affect food and drink. Because the kazayis of his nevela will eventually be matami tumah chamura when the person eats it. Two sides of the same coin, right? Nivlas Iftar, the Rameir, Maoshi Tami Kazayas. If it touches food, and you only have a kazayas of the nevela, can it generate tumah to that food or not? Well, the machsalar, if it's still sitting on the ground, right? Well, there's no question that it can't, because who says it's going to be eaten? Who says it's going to get to the point of generating a severe tumah upon eating? Who says he's eating it? The Nagar Bhumay, on the other hand, if he's already in his mouth, already being eaten, there's no question, on the other hand, that, of course, it's matama tumah kala even with the kazayis, because it's already in the process of being eaten. It's already sort of in the process of tumah chamura. Kiti Balach, the question will be somewhere in the middle. Nakla biyad, he's holding in his hands. Close to his mouth, but that's in his hand, right? Mechaz akreva, it's lacking delivery, meaning it's not yet in his mouth. Kimuchas amasadomi, it's considered lacking in its development component. So it's not yet considered something which is metame tumah chamura, and therefore will not be metame food or drink upon contact, if it's only a kazayis. Or shall we say, that, no, it's, you know, it has that potential, right? If you should choose to eat it, it's metame tumah chamura. So it already has that power now? It sounds from Rashi that if it's sitting on the floor, it's not giving tummy at all, let alone with a kazayis. It's not tummy at all, because it's not yet on the track of tumah chamura. Okay. However it is, the question relates to the fellow who's holding it in his hand, and you know, the question is, does it have the koyach to be metame tumah kala? Because it can potentially be metame tumah chamura when and if he decides to eat it. Okay, so the Gemara responds by saying, no. Mechusa kreva, yes, mechusa kreva, lavka mechusa masadami. The fact that it's lacking kreva, wasn't yet brought closer, meaning it wasn't put into his mouth, is not considered lacking in its development. And it's metame. Not only is it metame, it's metame food and drink, even though it's only a kazayis, which is the corresponding amount to tumah chamura, which it has the ability to generate. Okay, Eisven, now comes a kash. So we're saying that according to Rameir, even a kazayis of a nivlas oivtar is metame. A tumah kala? Is matame food and drink upon contact, really? Eisvi, here's a kasha. It's a Mishnah regarding a nivlas oivtar, shloish osadvarim. There were 13 principles, 13 halachas, nemru, which were applied to this very item, benivlas oivtar. We're not going to go through all 13, just a couple. V'ze'echad mehem. And this is one of those 13. Tzricha machshava. You have to decide. that you're going to eat it. Okay, Rashi explains, let's say there is food around that's tamei, but you need a kibetza of food to transmit tumah. You have, you know, kibetza minus a little bit, and you have a little of this material, the nivla seif tor, that you want to sort of combine it with that food to transmit tumah to something else. So you have to first determine that this nivla is going to be eaten, which renders it a food item. Of course, you don't have to rinse it with water. You don't have to moisturize it. As we said before, since it has a potential for a serious type of tumor, it doesn't require preparation. Okay, so this nivlas eftar is metam tumas eichlin, which means to say that it's considered like tummy food. And if it touches other food, it makes that food tummy. Provided, how much do you have? How much volume? Kibetza. So, why do you need a kibetza? Because ice is enough. Now, we're talking that he's holding it in his hand. Rashi explains. Because we said you have to have machshava, you have to decide. Now, if it's in his mouth already, you don't have to have machshava, he's eating it, right? So it must be that it's in his hands. So here we have a case of a nivlas iftar in your hands, which according to what we said before, already exhibits tumor, even by merely a kezias. And here we say, no, you need a kebetza to generate tumor. We don't say, well, we bust the norm, we bust the rules. Because it has the ability for higher tumor, then even a kezias has that ability to... No. At this point, you want to be metame tumas eichlin. Food that touches this nevel should become tameh. You need the required, the standard required amount. There's a kebetza. My love, Rameir. The Gemara is assuming that this is following Shitas Rameir. Apparently, because it's not enough. No, it's not Rameir. It's Le Rabbanon. It's Rabbanon. It's Rabbanon. We hold that we have to stick to the rules. We don't make exceptions. And it's treated like any other food that's tameh, which needs a kebetza. Says the Gemara, really, it's Rabbanu Vaktani Reisha. Let's go back to the beginning of the Mishnah. Tzricha Machshava Ben Tzricha Hechsher. You need to, you know, determine that it's going to be eaten. That renders it food. But you don't have to rinse it, you don't have to prepare it for its tumah. Which means to say we're bucking the rules. That sounds like Ramirez speaking. Uman Shamasli Hai Svara. Who seems to hold of this Svara, this opinion that, you know, things that have potential for severe tumor don't have to follow the standard system. You know, they don't need heksha. Who's that? That's your mayor. Just like by the live animal, he said it's matami, right? Umadereisha Rameir, sefinami Rameir. The fact that the first part of the Mishnah seems to be Rameir, let's assume the second part is Rameir too, not the Rabban, that's a kash. Mid area, you can't prove anything. Hokadisa, Hokadisa. This part is like Rameir, this part is like the Rabban. But Miktani Seifa, what do you mean? Let's move on to the next part of the Mishnah. Shchitaso melikasa metaheres treifasa metumasa. Say we shift to a slightly different topic. We had discussed this a while ago. Let's say you have a bird that was shechted, or there was a melika done in the Beis Hamidrash. Then, lo and behold, it was discovered to be a treifa. A treifa is not really edible. But aside from being inedible, it's really going to be tummy now, because it's like any other dead bird. The answer is no. According to Rav Meir's opinion, if the bird experienced a halachically valid shechita or malika, that spears it of any tumah. Although you can't eat it, but it's not tummy. Because the life termination occurred through a halachically valid process. That's Rav Meir's opinion. Man shamas li haisvar. Who's the one that adopts this approach? That's Rav Meir. Okay, now this is in this Mishnah here, where we say one part is Rameir, then it's Rabbana, now it's back to Rameir. Reish of a Sefer, the first and last segments of this Mishnah. Is Rameir speaking? Umitzias Rabbana, and the midpoint is Rabbana. It's a little bit unlikely. And look, if we're left with no choice, we'll say that in fact Reish of a Sefer Rameir, Umitzias Rabbana. In order to answer this question about the Kazayas Kabetza issue, we're compelled to conclude that in fact the first and last parts of the Mishnah is Rav Meir, the middle is Rabbanan, but according to Rav Meir, it can very well be that a nevela of an iftar is metame with merely a kazayis, which corresponds to the same shear that eventually is going to be metame to mechamura. Although it's an unconventional, non-typical, shear in accordance with Rav Meir, just like the live Sarah Mishaleach is metame oyechlin omashke. Amalei Rav Amnuna l'Rav Zeira. Says Rav Amnuna to Rav Zeira, I have an interesting question for you, and I insist that you answer me before you sit down. Le'teisiv akarach, don't sit down. Akarach on your feet, don't sit down. Ad amrus le'amils until you resolve the following question. Please tell me, Nivlas Oiftar, the Rav Meir. So according to Rav Meir, the kazayas, even a kazayas of a Nivlas Oiftar is already has the ability to metame food, right? Because of the potential for tumachabura on that same kazayas. So it already now will generate tuma upon contact, transmit tuma to another food. So technically, he should be considered like an avhatuma, like a source of tuma, in which case, when he touches food, it becomes a rishain, the next level, which now in turn can transmit to another food, which is a sheni. Shall we say that it has that ability to transmit all the way out there? Or perhaps it's sufficient. Suffice to say that he can be metama the first, but it stops there. Nivlas Eftar L'Rav Meir. Moinin L'Rishon V'Sheni? Do we count, the standard count? It goes to the next item, which is a Rishon, to the next item, which is a Sheni. Ein Moinin Rishon V'Sheni. Perhaps we don't apply this concept of Rishon V'Sheni. The fact is, this Nivlas Eftar cannot be metama a person at this point. Doesn't have that severe tumah to it. Because of the potential for severe tumah, eventually it already has some tumah activated on it. It can be tummy food. But perhaps it's a weaker tumah. Since it's limited to food, it's a one-stop tumah. It just goes one level and that's it. It can't continue. Moinin lo rishon v'sheni? Oy ein moinin rishon v'sheni. Amar leis, he says, the answer is no. Because only kalecha de matami adam b'maga, only a tumah source that can transmit tumah to a person by way of contact. Then we say, okay, it can generate, offspring, it can generate the whole chain of av to rishon to sheni. But in this case, where at this early stage, it doesn't have tumah chamura. Right? In fact, if a person touches the nevela of the eif tahar, it's not going to metame a person, right? So it doesn't have that ability. So even though it's a very severe type of tumor generator, but at most, it's metame the first item that it touches and it stops. It stops dead in its tracks. Kolecha, de ein metame, adam amaga, ein moin rishon v'sheni. Here comes another similar question. Boimini Rab Zeru, he asked me Rabbi Ami, Baruch Yev, Amrila, some say Rabbi Abin Barkahana. Hadas nam, we have a Mishnah, interesting Mishnah. Typically, only a kazayis of a nevela is metame, right? A dead animal. Okay, we're shifting to a standard nevela. A kazayis is metame upon contact. What if you have a half kazayis next to another half? And it's sort of connected by way of water. There's water perched in between, which sort of connects the two halves. Chiburei hadasnan, we learned in the Mishnah. Chiburei oichon, connecting foods, connecting the nevelos, aydemashkin, by way of liquid. Chibur l'tum kala, veint chibur l'tum chamura. Some reason, which Rashi says he doesn't know why, Loyadana, he says the reason for this. But in any case, that's the halacha. It makes a connection regarding lighter tumas. Basically, it grants the two halves the status of a whole. It makes that connection, a conductor, makes that connection, and now they give a metame to makala. If they touch food, they're metame. But it does not have the ability to transmit severe tuma to a person. Vein, chibur, l'tuma chamuru, because they don't have a full kazayis in one spot. Okay. So I have a similar question here. Something which currently is metami only to makala, but not to machamura. What happens when it touches food? How severely tumah does it make it? Can that tumah now be transmitted further to make a rishon and a sheni? Do we say no? It stops right there. It's a one, you know, one stop shop. Moina by rishon v'sheni. Oh yeah, moina by rishon v'sheni. Amalei says the answer is no. In line with our previous rule, kalecha de matami adam, an item that has the ability to matami a person, that's indicative of its strength. It's an ongoing thing that can just carry on and on. Moina by rishon v'sheni. It makes a rishon, which in turn can make a sheni. However, in this case, with these two separated halves, ein matami adam, then ein moina rishon v'sheni, it doesn't make a rishon sheni either. Okay, so bottom line is that those who handle the parah manisrafim, the parah adumo, sarah mishtaleach, they become tamei and they're begadim as well. But in terms of a food item that directly touches that par, it becomes tamei too. Right? Because although that item doesn't have hechsher, it doesn't have the standard, you know, preparation for tuma, but it's a self-generator of tuma, it's tamei tuma chamura. So it doesn't need to be prepared. It can generate tuma upon touching food. Rameh takes it a step further. He says even alive, sora mishtaleach, or in the case of niglas iftar, which is another example of something which has tuma chamura, even if it's just a kezayis, which is smaller than the standard requirement, can also be metame eichel mashkim. But as the Gemara concludes, it's a one-time opportunity. It doesn't carry on to the next time. Yotzu eilu veilu. Mishnah says, although the parim hanisrafim meant to be carried all the way out, we called chutz l'sholish machnes. We use that term because in the midbar they had machnes, encampments, right? So the Mishkan actually was called a machna shchina, ringed around by the levim, which are called machna levia. Then you have the outer ring, which is the general encampment of Klal Yisrael, called a machna Yisrael, and they had to burn it all the way outside, all three. So in the Beis HaMikdash, we have the Beis HaMikdash, we have the Harabais, we have the Yerushalayim, 1, 2, 3, and it was carried all the way out. However, in terms of Tumas Begadim, the carriers, they become Tumas as soon as it leaves the Beis HaMikdash, as soon as it leaves the Azara. How do we know that's true? How do we know that Tumas arrives so early in the process? As soon as they leave the premises, they Begadim become Tumas. How do we know they become Tumas so early? So in Rabbanu, we have a Braisa, which will give us the precise locations for burning the various karbanis, and we'll see exactly when the tumah happens. Tana Rabbanu, we have a pasuk regarding the par of Yom Kippur, which is one of those that are burnt outside Lahalam. So elsewhere, by the par of the Kohen Mashiach, the par Helam Davashal Tzibur, which is a carbon that the Tzibur will bring if they sinned, if they erred, or the Kohen Gadol will bring. So over there it says, Vo'emer chutz l'shalish machnes, you burn it outside Yerushalayim. Kan, but over here by Yom Kippur, the machna achas. It just says take it out of one machna. How could you say that? We learned that actually they're meant to be the same locations. So what then does the pasuk mean when it relates to a single machna? Leimlech to tell you. Sure, you burn it all the way outside, but the tumas begadim gets applied right now. Kivan sheyotza. Leimlech kivan sheyotza. Chus lamachna achas. As soon as you take it out one machna, as you take it out of the azari, you begadim atam. Now the premise was that the Sreifa actually takes place outside all three. How do we know that? If you go for Minol, how do we know that it's outside all three? The Tanur Rabban, we have a price. This is by the Par Koyed Mashiach. Voitiyas kol ha-par l'chus l'machne. Take it out. L'chus l'machne. It means chus l'sholish machne. It's outside all three. Ato, are you suggesting outside all three? Chus l'sholish machne? So, yeinu yalom machnachas. Maybe it means outside just one machne. That's what it says, right? But when the pasuk says "v'paraeda," by the other carbon, "paraeda," it says "mechus l'mach," take it out and burn it "mechus l'mach," which is really a redundancy. Shein tzarachleim, it's unnecessary because we already know that the parhelam davar shel tzibur is meant to be burned at the same location as the parakoy mashiach, which is presumably outside one machne. Shekhar Nehmer already says, "Burn it in the same place, kasha sarafas parish, where you burnt the first one by the parakoy mashiach." So leave out the description. It's the same location. Oh, the reason for repeating the word machne again was to tell you, take it out another machne. Liten le machne shnia, take it out two machnes. How do we know all three? Now we move on to the next, the pasuk there, which says, "Kosamach b'deshen." This is by the deshen. Kohen is meant to take some ashes and, you know, the ashes of, you know, whatever is left on the mizbeach, take it out, mechutz lamachne. Take it out of the area, which again is a redundancy, because we know that deshen is meant to be taken out mechutz lamachne, because by the parkoy mashiach it says burn it outside the machne al shefach hadeshen, where you land the ashes. Apparently you land the ashes outside the machne, right? Sort of a reverse source, right? Kshoyim mechutz lamachne b'deshen, when the pasuk describes the deshen as being taken mechutz lamachne, shetzorach leimar, which is unnecessary, Shekhar Nemet already says by the burning of the Parakoy Mashiach, which we know is Chuslam Achne, it says do it where the Deshen is. Apparently it's one in the same place. Al Shevach Deshen Yisarev, where you pour the Deshen. So why the extra Loshen Chuslam Achne? Litzin Lamachne Shlishis, to add yet another Machne. So now you know the delivery of the Deshen, the burning of all these Purim, are way outside the city. But in terms of Tumas Pekadim, that occurs immediately, as soon as you leave one Machne. Now, in the Mishnah, we had Rav Shimon's Shita. Tumas Begadim only occurs while burning, not as soon as you leave the area. Hi, Mechus L'machan, what does he do with the Chachamim source? Mechus L'machan, which sounds like it happens now. Mebarele, it's needed for totally, totally different halach. Kedusanya, the Brisa says like this. Rav Lezer, Oim. Nemar Khan, we have by these Parim, the Loshen of Chus L'machan. Remember, we have elsewhere by the Parah Duma, Chus L'machan, we connect. Ma'akan, Chus L'shol L'shmachan, it's just like over here by the Paramas and Esrafim, they're outside all three. Afalahal, by Paraduma as well, you burn it beyond all three machnes. And we also make a reverse connection. Umahal, just like by the Paraduma, it's processed to the east of Yerushalayim. That's where you do the spreading of the blood. Mizrach Yerushalayim, because the Pasuk said you do it on that side. Afkan, likewise. Where do we burn the Par and Sar of Yom Kippur? The Mizrach Yerushalayim, although we know it's beyond all three machnes outside Yerushalayim, but to which direction? To the east of Yerushalayim. That's where the burning area was. Okay, so according to Rav Shimon, we have the words Muchtal Machne to connect it to the Paraduma to provide precise location to the east. El Rabbanan says the Gemara, but according to Rabbanan, who evidently don't have this Dera Shavah because they use the Mechus L'machna for something else. Hechi Sarif Lu, so what do we burn? These cows? Kedesanya, Bryce says, Hechi Nesrafim, where is it burned? Litzfon Yushalayim, Chutz L'shal Shmachna, actually, it was to the north of Yushalayim, beyond, you know, the city. And why Dafka to the north? Rashi says, Shekol Masachatas B'tzofim, we know that Shechita V'chatas is on the Tzofen of the Azara. So Chatas relates to Tzofen. Presumably you burn it on the north of Yerushalayim as well. Interestingly, we talk about the place of Shefach HaDeshen, and I once read an article, fascinating piece, that years ago, about 100 or so years ago, to the north of the old city, there was a pile of ashes, a huge mound of ashes, which was known amongst the locals of the Yidden, who it was known by tradition as a place called Shefach HaDeshen. That's where the ashes of the Karbonis throughout, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of the Beis HaMikdash's activity, that's where the ashes were delivered. And actually it corresponds to the opinion of the Rabbanim, because it was to the north of Yerushalayim, right outside the old city where the Mandelbaum gate is over there. That's where the Shefach HaDeshen was. And I read that it was known, it was a huge mound. Everybody knew this was from the Beis HaMikdash, this was the remnant of the Karbonis. And it was there for hundreds and hundreds of years, until I think at the turn of the century they made some sort of the Goyim had some sort of soap factory, and they would snatch from that material and they would use it for their soap manufacturing, and it slowly decreased and shrunk, and then it lost its whole totally was depleted. In fact, I read a very fascinating piece that that there was a Rav, I forget which, a Rebbe in Europe, when he heard about the Shefach HaDeshen, he asked that they send him. Somebody went in there and found a piece of a horn. Presumably from a carbon of Beis HaMikdash. Can you imagine 1,000 years old? Imagine how inspiring it is to touch a piece of a carbon of Beis HaMikdash. It's mutar b'arnah, because it's already burnt, it's ashes. It's. And they sent it to this Rebbe in Europe, and he was so moved and just touched by actually experiencing and handling material that came from the Hilag of Beis HaMikdash. She bought a Beis HaMikdash, Merav Yemin. So in that case, the location, it struck me, the location corresponds to the Shitas Rabbanon, who say that the Shevach HaDeshen, it would deposit the ashes to the north of the area, which was slightly to the north of Yerushalayim. Okay. Heichan HaShrofon L'Sfon Yerushalayim Chutz L'Shol Shmachnis. Rabbi Yisak Lili Omer, there's another aspect regarding the location of the burning of these karbonis. A base hadeshen is strafen. He says you have to burn it. It's not a question just of location. You have to burn on ashes. The pasuk says ashevach hadeshen. It has to be sitting on ashes. So you have to make sure there was some ashes sitting there before you burn these karbonis. Now that's his opinion, but apparently the Tanakam in the first sheet and the Brisa doesn't require this. This condition to be met. Amar Rava Mantana. So let's put a name to the face. Who's the opinion? What's the name of the Shita, the Palagalita Rishagli, who disagrees and does not require ashes to be present while burning these carbonates? Rav Elazar ben Yaakovi. It says Shita, the Sanyo. Because according to him, the words Al Shevach Hadeshen and Yisarev is teaching something else. The Sanyo, the bright Tanakhama says Al Shevach Hadeshen and Yisarev means there's got to be some ashes there. Sheishem Deshen. Rav Elazar ben Yaakovi, no. Shefach means it's sort of an incline that you can, you know, pour it there and it rolls down. So that's all. It's a matter of incline. It's not a matter of having the deshen present there. So that's the opposing sheet. I'm like, Abaye, you know, who says he disagrees? Maybe he agrees. He just requires two conditions. Perhaps he agrees to the first premise that it has to be deshen there for it to be considered a mokem shefach deshen. But he also holds it has to be done on a slant. In order to be considered a poor, and that's the additional requirement, but perhaps the presence of deshen is required according to all shittas. Okay, let's just see one more piece and finish the parah. Tana Rabbanan. So we speak about those involved in transporting and burning the parim, whose clothing become tamei. Tana Rabbanan v'asoyref. Okay, one walks over to the burning, to the fire, and gets involved there. His begodim become tamei. Asoyref metamei begodim. So only one who's involved in the actual sreifa. V'leah matzah says ur metame begodim, but not one who just simply lights the fire. V'leah masad masad rach, and certainly not the fellow who just merely arranged the firewood. He's not going to be metame begodim because he's not actually assisting in the actual burning process. V'izeu asoyref. Who's the soyref that in fact affects his begodim? I'm going to say abishas asreifa, who's actively involved while it's being burnt. The burning process, which consumes most of the par, and that's considered active involvement, which affects his begadim. Yochel afin shenasu efer. Now, until what point? Suppose he walked in there and started getting involved after everything turned to ashes. Perhaps they were also metamim begadim. No, they're not metamim begadim. Tamaloymar oisam. Only oisam who burns them. Oisam when they're still intact is what to burn. Those people are metamim begadim, as opposed to. To our fellow, once they turn to ashes, it's over. Shimon Omer has a slightly different version. While they're intact, once the flesh becomes sort of dissolved, then the action is over. There's no too much begodim going forward. What's the difference between Tanakam, who spoke about turning into ashes, and Shimon spoke about dissolving? The difference will be the Shavi Harucha. Suppose the fire had already fully, charred the basa, but not yet afer. So according to Tanakama, there's still what to do. It's not yet fully incinerated. And if one approaches the fire now and gets involved, he's begadim become tami. According to Reb Shimon, it's called already nitach habasar. It's already shows over, and it can no longer affect those who are now going to choose to be involved. Hadron left for you. Okay, so we spoke about the Tumas Begadim that applies to those that are involved in handling these karbonis, the Parah Manistrafim, Sirim Manistrafim, the Parah Aduma, the Sarah Mishtaleach. According to Tanakam, as soon as they leave the area, according to Shimon, the Tumah only happens when the animal becomes mostly consumed. That's when their Begadim become Tamei. We spoke about an interesting thing that although these aren't necessarily dead, they're shechted, but they still have the ability to be metame, a plain, basic, simple tuma as well. So if food touches these things, they become tame. Not if a person touches them, just food, tuma kala, because these things Soifer l'tama tuma chamer, they're generators of severe tuma, eventually, right, for the people that are involved in them. So they have that sort of tuma generating capacity with respect to other things as well. If they touch food or drink, they become tameh. Kodermei, we take it even a step further. But they don't have to abide by the conventional rules and regulations, even alive, Sarah Mishtaleach, or even a Nivlas Iftar, the size of a Kazayas, has that ability as well. We actually did say that it's limited to the extent that it's going to be sort of a one-time thing. It's not going to carry on to Shirisha and Visheni, as usually happens. And we learned about the exact location where to burn these karbonos, according to so it's totally beyond the three machnis. That's a given. According to Rabbi Shimon, it was according to Belezer, it was l'mizrocha. Shal Yerushalayim according to Rabbanon, it was l'tzfoinam. Shal Yerushalayim shibona b'tamidash mer b'meinu. Amen. All the best to you, Natzlochara.